This is America Unfiltered, a fresh, raw look at American politics, foreign policy, and media. With me, Liam Kennedy, in Dublin.
And me, Scott Lucas, in Birmingham, in the United Kingdom.
Scott, happy birthday. You're an American, and it's happy birthday to the United States. This is a special American birthday episode coming into the July weekend. I think we'll call this the American Carnage episode as well. What are we looking into? The after effects and heightened effects of COVID, of protests. This is going to be a strange weekend in the United States. So happy birthday, Scott.
Hey, thanks for ruining my celebration, even as I was trying to put the candles on the cake. But you're right. There's going to be a curious juxtaposition on July the 4th, where Donald Trump, again pursuing re-election, is going to stand in front of Mount Rushmore, you know, and it's going to be Lincoln, it's going to be Washington, it's going to be Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Trump implicitly saying, I should be the fifth one up there. When as he's sitting there, breaking social distancing rules to gather some folks around him to make him feel good, you've got this record spike of coronavirus cases now 5 months into the pandemic. Six records in the last 9 days is what I'm looking at here. Yesterday was more than 53,000 confirmed cases.
Yeah, 55,000 plus. And did you notice the states that are getting a hit are, how shall I put it, a little bit red?
Yeah, they are. And they're not only red, they are in cases where the governors moved really quickly when Trump said, we've got to reopen, we've got to reopen, again, for the sake of his reelection. So the first state that reopened, I think April 30th it was Georgia. They're at about 150% increase in cases over the last 2 weeks. Texas and Florida both are setting daily records and increasing at about 175%. You could say the same for Tennessee. You could say the same for Arizona, which is about 240% increase in cases. And it drives home the point that they reopened not for public health reasons. You know, the medical experts said, don't do it. This was done purely because they were backing up Trump's idea, which is come November, we've got to show an economic uptick in order to hold the White House and in order to hold state legislators. And now just to, you know, what death toll now is going to be 130,000 by the time we get through this July 4th weekend.
Yeah, we find that some of these state leaders are beginning to rethink whether masks should be worn. I mean, Greg Abbott now in Texas is saying that Texans should wear masks. That's going a bit up and down. And it looks like Donald Trump has finally taken to masks, except he wears them over his eyes. He says he looks like the Lone Ranger.
do you really think he's the Lone Ranger? Or do you think he's, as he said in that tweet a couple days earlier, in all caps, the Lone Warrior?
Either way, we can sit here at this side of the Atlantic and say it's insane to politicize mask wearing, but that is what's happened, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a really vivid image that I think some of our listeners may have seen, which comes out of Austin, Texas. Now, Austin's a fairly liberal city in Texas. You know it really well.
It's the only one I've been to. I thought I was in New York.
Yeah, and you got someone who's wearing a mask, and he's confronted by three guys who are just in his face, probably spitting in his face almost, as they're just like just berating him for wearing this. And what we've really seen is that, you know, you study culture wars, you write about culture wars, and masks are now part not only of this public health crisis, but this idea of culture wars, that in some way, if you wear a mask, you're weak, that you're letting government run all over you. And that's what Trump, he didn't bring that to America, but he's exacerbated it. And I'm really worried. You know, I got parents who are in their 80s in Georgia, which is now a hotspot. So when they go out to the supermarket as vulnerable people, you know, they can wear masks. But what if everybody else is defying it and also sort of casting shade on them for simply trying to protect their lives?
But do you think the mask wearing is showing up, I don't know, a kind of limit point with the culture wars? I don't see this as quite working for Trump in the way that, you know, he's been able to pick up on certain issues. He turns them into issues of division, right? This is not quite getting the traction, or it's even getting reversal. So, for example, a couple of years ago, you know, Trump said, you shouldn't be bending the knee as an athlete, right? That's un-American. That disrespects the flag. Shouldn't be done. That was a good example of him dividing America, right? Pushing a hot button issue. But look where we are now. The NFL is saying it's okay to do that. You have policemen and women bending the knee. Is he losing his talent to direct the culture war, do you think?
Well, I think the immediate context is that if it had just been coronavirus on its own, if it had just been Black Lives Matter and the anti-racism marches on its own, if it had just been an economic dip on its own, he's still, quote, in control. At least, you know, his approval rating's holding up. But when you get the convergence of all of this, then I think, no, I think you get one of those inflection points which we will look back on as being a key one in American history, which is when people said, look, we're going down the wrong path here. And so Trump's really aggressive way of those all caps, law and order, right? No testing. You know, people look at it and I'll say, well, no, this doesn't make sense in terms of our lives. You know, it's one thing to shout when you think, you know, there's no threat to you. But when you think it's going to hit you, whether or not you're Republican or Democrat, then it can backfire.
That's the big question. This stuff seems real now. It's not abstract anymore. And I think Trump's having a bit of a problem in bending things to his will and sort of trying to bend American reality. He's sort of felt he could do that for some time. There's a lot of pundits now beginning to question whether he's run out of steam, whether his ratings have run out of steam, or what exactly is going on, that, as you say, it's some kind of inflection moment. I don't know. I still wouldn't bet either way with this going on. But there's another little thing happening, which I think is interesting, and that is to see the big social media tech companies beginning to listen in a way they hadn't listened before. We're seeing a bit of that as well, aren't we? In the last week alone, I see that, Reddit has got rid of some of the subreddits that were, you know, speaking hate, basically. We've seen that Facebook has begun to, you know, throw up new safeguards, or at least talk about doing those in a way that seems a bit more practical. And even YouTube has thrown, I think, David Duke and a few others, off its site. And in July, Congress is going to be hauling these companies before it, you know, to talk about antitrust issues. Are we going to see a different behavior here, which could have a huge, you know, effect on the election, but also just on how Americans talk to each other?
It's only a beginning. It's an important beginning. I mean, God, we need a bit of decency. But, for example, Twitter has taken to flagging tweets, including the president's tweets, if they are blatant disinformation or if they are effectively hate speech. You have seen Reddit move against some groups. Facebook says it's going to make a move, but I think right now Facebook's still digging its heels in, even as advertisers threaten or pulling off of the site because it won't remove hate posts. And the reason why I say it's only a beginning, Liam, is that it's not just a question of trying to get responsibility and dialogue and so on, that even as we say Trump is in trouble, and we'll see what November brings, that administration is using coronavirus and Black Lives Matter, ironically, as cover for not only feeding the rhetoric. So they go in and they feed the rhetoric, for example, about the others who threaten America from within. And they still have Fox News. They still have Breitbart. They still have Pajamas Media. They still have a lot of social media people who can do that without any type of check. And that has practical effects. So in the last month, let's take the key issue of immigration. They've started to restrict asylum or move further to restrict asylum. They have moved to restrict or threaten legal immigrants with deportation by saying, if you take public service benefits, if you take healthcare benefits, if you take food stamps, you can be pushed out of the country. And this project, which is being led by a real xenophobe, Stephen Miller, you know, the fact is that he doesn't get the headlines of pushback like you and I are talking about right now, because everybody's having to look at the virus and Black Lives Matter. And that's what worries me, that they still have, even if they lose the election, they still got another 6 months to do further damage.
Immigration issues are still absolutely hot button and will be huge in the election. The use of the executive orders have been so important there. One of Trump's first acts was to, you know, try and prevent people coming from certain countries around the world into the United States. And as you say, in the last couple of weeks, we've had a series of executive orders that are really spreading out these restrictions and causing a lot of concern. They're also causing confusion. To try and get some enlightenment on that, I thought we would talk a little bit more about immigration this week. And so I caught up with Fiona McEntee, who's an immigration attorney in Chicago. And Fiona has been working very closely on these issues for some time. Fiona, you yourself are an immigrant, and it seems like it's been quite a journey to take you from Ireland to Chicago, to a law degree, to a law attorney, to running a law office. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, so I feel like I will be eternally grateful to UCD because I ended up in Chicago through an exchange program when I was studying law there during my bachelor's degree. So it was 2002. So it's been quite a while, but I came here to Chicago originally for a year to study at the DePaul Law School here through the exchange program. And then I went back to graduate, and then I came back out here and got my Juris Doctor. And since I graduated here in 2007, I've been practicing immigration law ever since. And I was really drawn to that area of law, being an immigrant. And I think especially being an Irish immigrant, recognizing that with that comes in my mind a certain amount of privilege And so I feel like I want to use that, the voice. I now have the privilege of being a US citizen and a dual US Irish citizen. And I think that, you know, there's just a bit more comfort in speaking out and in doing various things when you do have the privilege of citizenship. And so I try to use that to advocate for all immigrants and in different ways. And I think that a lot of my colleagues, my immigration lawyer colleagues, will probably agree that, you know, we don't just wear the immigration attorney hat anymore. You know, we add other hats on, and one of those would be kind of the activist hat. And so what I find myself doing on a daily basis is, of course, cases and advising clients. But I also do lots of things that maybe people wouldn't traditionally think of as being kind of lawyer, you know, type duties. I do a lot of like media interviews and sharing stories. I will help reporters understand some of the, you know, travel ban, you know, just right now at the moment, I'm helping them kind of navigate some of the legal issues in the travel ban and kind of how that might apply to just people depending on where they are. I also have written a children's book that is my way of sharing my immigration clients' stories in a way to hopefully have a different conversation around immigration. It's been really negative and I think exhausting for people to hear just immigrants being constantly attacked. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues, we want to have a different conversation, one that we know to be true of, you know, and kind of reflective of the immigrants that we see coming to America.
Chicago itself, of course, great history as an immigration city. Today, being in Chicago, being a lawyer, what are the big issues that face you locally? Before we get into the national scene, what are people coming to your law firm to get help on?
You know, it's pretty varied. It could be at the moment, I am just absolutely delighted that we're doing new DACA cases. So for the Dreamers, I'm sure that has been on the news probably everywhere. So we actually, based on the Trump administration's attempt to basically terminate that program, we have been unable to file new DACA applications since September of 2017. So I'm just absolutely delighted that this week we're going to be filing our first initial DACA application since that time. And we're doing that notwithstanding the fact that the USCIS has yet to announce procedures for filing new applications. We feel very comfortable based on the Supreme Court decision that we can go ahead and file those. So that's an example of one case that we're filing right now. We also handle a lot of extraordinary ability visas. So we work with a lot of entrepreneurs or let's say musicians, co-founders of startups, you know, even people in fashion, beauty, you know, social media influencers, that type of thing. So pretty like varied clientele with regards to those visas, but we're doing a lot of those, especially at the moment.
Well, getting on to President Trump, but it's hard not to when it comes to talking about immigration. It seems like immigration issues have been a massive part of his platform, both in running for the presidency and throughout. I mean, he wasn't president for long when he was already issuing executive orders that were really impacting the system very, very fast. Can you remember just back that far before we get to the present? I mean, were you surprised? Was it a shock? How did people in your area of work, you know, how did you receive this new president when he arrived and he began to talk about immigration using language which not many presidents had used before him, not recently?
You know, I certainly do. And I'm laughing not because it's funny, but it honestly is something I will never forget. You know, all throughout the campaign trail, we saw now President Trump, his attacks on immigrants were relentless. He threatened to ban Muslims. So I don't think we should have been surprised when he actually followed through on that threat. But obviously the wall rhetoric, it's not just rhetoric, it's turned into actual policy. It was forthcoming, basically, what he was going to do. But in regards to the Muslim ban, I mean, that experience, I think, changed my career insofar as the activism that came out, that has come out in me and my colleagues since then. But even before the executive order was signed, that particular executive order, So, I mean, honestly, there's just so many travel bans. Like, even now, there's been so many this week. But back then, this is the first version of the Muslim ban. You know, we had signed up to be on call to go to the airport as immigration lawyers in advance of anything even being signed. And what happened on that first day is something that I will never, ever forget. And the absolute chaos. There were, I mean, we ended up representing a man with, he was there waiting for his wife and his 18-month-old child to be released from CBP secondary detention custody, essentially. And the child was a US citizen. And the wife, the mother of the child, was a green card holder. And the only reason they were being held was because they had, you know, the mom was originally from Iran and was based on this, you know, at the time that order was not lawful. And that's why they had to change it multiple times to get it to a point that I felt, you know, maybe the Supreme Court would think was palatable. But yeah, so that's, you know, that's how you started out and things have gone from bad to worse.
So let's talk about worse, or the latest of the worst. You started a reference there, recent bans, recent restrictions. In April, we saw an executive order restricting a whole slew of people from entering into the United States or re-entering to the United States. That's been followed up in the last week in quite complex and confusing ways. What's been going on over the last 6 weeks in this area?
Yeah, I think that's you know, a good point to make. I feel like this administration, in their haste to, you know, attack immigrants on so many levels, they are sloppy with their drafting. And, you know, going back to the Muslim ban, how there were so many iterations of it. I mean, we've even seen it right now with the most recent executive orders. So on my desk, I have multiple orders printed out and I have them all tabbed and I'm just calling them different, you know. Oh, this is the non-immigrant visa ban. This is the green card ban. This is the COVID travel ban. This is the amendment to the non-immigrant visa ban. Even the most recent one, so the one that you might have heard about with the banning of H-1B visas or L transfer visas and J-1s. So that one, I'll call that the business visa ban. And even that one has since been amended and it's only been a week. So they originally, the White House put out an executive order and that, to be honest, the scope was pretty clear. It was pretty clear who it should apply to based on the wording, but it obviously was not to the White House's liking because since then they've issued an amendment that came out. I actually heard about it through a reporter, emailed me late on Monday evening. At 9 p.m., she got a message from the White House press office and she asked me, what's the difference? Can you explain what the amendment means? And so essentially they've broadened the scope of it since it's been issued again.
So what groups of people are most seriously affected by these rolling bans?
So the bans are done under the guise of, you know, the president's authority to restrict entry of certain aliens or people into the US. And they essentially cover, so the COVID-related travel ban that we've heard about, that's what's preventing people from Ireland from coming in. That's, you know, and I guess I'm not going to use the word irony, but Ireland has such a handle on COVID compared to, let's say, in the US and even in the EU. I've heard that, you know, the latest reports had said that the cases in Florida were even more than all of the EU combined. So, you know, the fact that travelers can't come in, but I guess that's a different thing. So that's the COVID-related travel ban. And the green card ban is impacting would-be green card holders from coming into the US, the people who would be making entry for the first time or getting those kind of green, like immigrant visas, stamps at consulates abroad. And then this other one is restricting temporary workers in various categories from coming into the US. But there's also been, in my opinion, unlawful expansion of this by the Department of State in other ways as well. They're trying to extend this to people who were in the US and might leave and then try to come back in. And so there is still, in my opinion, a lot of confusion about who's subject to these orders.
This is confusing for people over this side of the Atlantic trying to read about it. What's it like there? I mean, is the confusion part of what drives people to you? I mean, is this where some of your clients are coming? Is it just confusion or do they know exactly what they need from you? I mean, to what degree are you trying to really just explain things to people?
All the time, all day long. I mean, I'm trying to, and I will say that the panic that we are, you know, hearing from all different types of clients in all different scenarios. So, I mean, I'm getting all these messages on Twitter and Instagram, like, I have a, you know, I have this situation. Am I going to be banned? Can I leave? Can I, you know? And so it's very confusing. You have to think that this is part of the plan because, you know, otherwise, why not be clear about who's subject to it? I mean, even in advance of executive orders being issued, you know, we've seen tweets by Trump saying banning all immigration, you know, these like widespread statements that really create absolute panic. And, you know, from my point of view, we deal with people every day. These are people's lives. These are people's. And you saw that, let's say, with DACA, you know, the Supreme Court kind of chastised the administration for disregarding the impact of people's lives and their work here. And, you know, and I think that it is reckless and it is not right that that people who are here contributing so much to this country are made feel so unwelcome. And, you know, and some of them are now banned because they happen to have been abroad when some of these orders were issued.
You said something very interesting in that you said that perhaps, you know, the drive for this for the Trump administration is to create confusion. And there are patterns in the Trump presidency where, you know, disruption has been something of a strategy in certain sectors. And you do wonder if it's here because I'm not seeing an awful lot of logic, or if there is a logic, please explain it to me. I mean, if you're going to restrict, you know, H-1B, then you're restricting people who are coming in, you know, to work in the tech industries and so on. But at the same time, you're saying, hey, we want to create a merit-based system for immigration. That doesn't make sense, does it?
No, you're right. And I think it's completely inconsistent with some of the stated objectives in relation to like merit-based immigration. And I would say, first off, I certainly I'm not a fan of, you know, favoring one type of immigrant over the other, unlike the current administration. You know, one thing that I thought was pretty chilling, and I'm looking actually at a quote, it was in the Washington Post, but it was in relation to this executive order. It's from Stephen Miller, who has been the president's kind of main advisor in relation to immigration. And he is saying, when you suspend the entry of new immigrants from abroad, you're also reducing immigration further because the chain of follow-on migration that are disrupted. So he's basically saying, he said, so the benefit to the American workers compounds with time. So like compound with time, it's like compound interest. You know, when you think of this, they're now looking at cutting off the flow and seeing the future. This is like, these are people, you know, and they're contributing so much. And it's such a us versus them type way to view immigration. And that's not at all reflective of what happens when immigrants come to the US. It's not a one-way street of take. It's a two-way relationship.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, you know, most economists agree that, you know, immigration is a economic and business plus in the United States at all levels. And I assume that's why there's been a lot of big business, you know, stepping up to lobby against what Trump is currently doing.
Yeah, there have been. And I actually recently wrote an opinion piece for USA Today. It was specific to foreign students, but and why. Because another threat that we had heard was that they were thinking the administration, actually, four Republican senators had urged the president to terminate the work permit that foreign students get on graduation. But, you know, my piece cites a lot of hard data about the economic contributions that foreign students make. And in terms of, you know, innovation, in terms of studying in fields that are, you know, that the US maybe historically does not have the talent in those types of areas. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that those economic contributions are clear. As far as the tech industry stepping up, I am happy to see that because I think there's safety in numbers with regards to, you know, some smaller clients feel like they don't want to be victimized by the administration. They're nervous. They're reluctant to come forward and take legal action against the administration. And I think seeing the likes of Apple, Google, you know, Facebook, whoever speak out against this is really important. I think that they have a unique position and a platform, and I'm delighted to see them use that in support of their staff. But to be honest, they have to, because they need this talented workforce, you know, as much as anybody. So, you know, I think I would have been surprised if they didn't speak out.
And again, I don't see the logic there, because I noticed that in India, you know, this is grabbing headline news because people are concerned about quite highly educated Indians who are working in the tech industry in the United States and how they're affected. And the logic of that, again, doesn't make sense, because Trump, we know, is reaching out to the Indian diaspora in the United States in the hope that he can get support there coming into the election. I just don't see the joined up thinking in this. Is this purely playing to his base and nothing else? I mean, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, you know, it is kind of head scratching as well. And we would have a lot of Indian clients that we would represent that would be, let's say, on H-1Bs. And in my experience, the majority of them do come here as foreign students, and they study and they get their master's here. They pay top dollar for their American education. And I fail to see how, you know, implementing the very restrictive business immigration policies is going to win support of any type of immigrant community. And it's ultimately going to hurt America. And I'm not an economist, obviously. But I mean, I've read a lot of the economic studies, and I actually recently looked at a report, and there was some leading economists were surveyed in relation to the new business ban, and they were asked for their opinion on whether this is going to hurt the US in the short and long term. And I can send you the link to the study, and we could, I don't know if you can put it in the notes for the show or something so people can see the kind of polls, but it was basically like they overwhelmingly agreed that policies like this would hurt America both in the short term and in the long term if they were to continue.
Looking toward the election, well, we're anticipating that there may be an election. We don't know what's going to happen. We think there's going to be an election in the US in November. But assuming that there is, do you think immigration is going to be at the center of that? Or how do you think it's going to be framed? What's going to really be at issue in the immigration debate coming into the election, do you think?
It naturally has to be, given the Trump administration's anti-immigrant, you know, everything, stance, rhetoric, policies. So, you know, obviously the Biden campaign has to address that. And I think that we're going to see, hopefully we'll see some debate on these issues. And I have looked at Joe Biden's, Vice President Biden's plan for immigration. And so he has made a commitment to get comprehensive immigration reform done, or to complete it as possible within the first 100 days. And it's pretty broad plan. And so I hope we get a chance to work on that plan. But I do think between now and then, immigration will likely form a central part of the campaigns on both sides.
There has been comment that Joe Biden maybe hasn't pushed out too much that's concrete around immigration policy just yet. He did a couple of days ago talk about increasing the numbers of asylum seekers who would be received into the United States, which is certainly running very counter to what Donald Trump has been saying. Can we anticipate a big change with Joe Biden, do you think, if he is president, around immigration?
Definitely. I mean, looking at the immigration plan that he has up on his website, it is very detailed. It covers a lot of different immigration policies. I will say that it touches on family immigration. It talks about the humanitarian immigration, like the asylum. It also addresses business immigration and the kind of the issues that we have with the current business immigration system, you know, referencing STEM workers and the need for like visa reform in certain industries. And, you know, even going into like agricultural workers. And so from what I see, it's a very detailed policy. It also discusses preserving the diversity visa, which is like the green card lottery. And I know that's important to people in Ireland as well. And so the Trump administration has been threatening to get rid of that for the longest time. And actually, people who won that lottery are now prevented from getting their green cards through these bans. And there's some litigation in relation to that. So from what I've seen, it's a pretty comprehensive plan. And I am going to do whatever I can to to assist, to hope that we will be able to implement this plan in a few short months, probably long months. They'll probably be the longest months of our lives, but hopefully we'll get to see some of these plans, you know, be implemented.
Fiona, I hope you have that opportunity, and we have an opportunity to talk to you again, maybe in a year's time. You can tell us how that's going.
Yeah, that would be, I would be delighted. Hopefully we'll be sitting here having a completely different conversation around immigration.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Fiona McEntee, a former graduate of University College Dublin, and now an immigration attorney in Chicago, where she is the founding and managing partner of McEntee Law Group. To find out more about her children's book and some of the articles she mentioned, do check out our website at ucdclinton.ie. This was a special 4th of July episode of America Unfiltered. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts from. Happy birthday, America. I'm Liam Kennedy. Goodbye from Dublin.